Welcome to the Human Centered Leadership Podcast with me, your host, Colm Hay. I have worked in the leadership space for 3 decades, and now I work with organizations and leaders to develop powerful cultures of high value and performance that is built all around their people. We will interview leaders from around the world and at the very top end of their game to explore what emotional intelligence in practice actually looks like and the benefits that it could bring to any team. This is a movement to transform the way that we see leadership and to create powerful cultures where people feel seen, heard, valued and appreciated, and consequently perform to the very best. Why don't you join the movement and subscribe to our podcast? And don't forget to click on notifications to stay up to date with all new content.
Welcome to another episode where I get to speak to incredible leaders from around the globe.
And indeed, today I am traveling around the world. We're going all the way to Tanzania and Africa, where we're speaking to an incredible leader. Tavinder Puri is somebody I've been following on LinkedIn for a while now. You've got an incredible breadth and depth of experience around HR in all sorts of incredible organizations. We're going to hear a bit more about that in a short while, but now run your own organization called ADP Advisory Services in Tanzania, and largely traveling all over Africa doing some brilliant work around leadership. I've been drawn to it, so I want to hear more about it. Tavinder, welcome to the program. It's really good to have you here.
Well, thank you for asking me. I was really pleased when you dropped in my inbox to say, would you like to be on? And I was like, great. What do you want to know?
Well, as somebody who does something very similar to what you do, I'm always on the lookout for people who are doing really, really good work in this area of leadership development and people development. And some people stand out to me. You know what it's like. You see a lot of people making a lot of noise on social media, but I'm always looking for somebody who seems to be very value-driven, very professional, and very consistent. And you seem to be all of those things. So I have been drawn to your work, and I think you're doing some incredible work. I want to know more about that. I can't wait to learn. But at first, before we go any further, I need to delve into your history, because you have worked in all sorts of organizations. Just tell us a bit about where you've been, who you've been, and how you've got to where you are right now.
So I studied economics at university, and I was fortunate enough to get selected to join a graduate program. So 3,500 people applied to join the Halifax, and I was one of the fortunate 31. And over the course of 2 years, they invested over £200,000 in giving us real leadership exposure, experience, mentorship around becoming a middle manager, a fast track program. Yeah. And as you know, financial services in the UK is highly regulated. So I would say that I cut my teeth in a very professional sector. I kind of learned best practice approaches when it comes to managing people, managing complexity, managing volume. And that was my learning ground. And I was fortunate enough to have some amazing bosses who took the time whilst I was on this program to really help me and guide me around, you know, managing banks for people. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was a girl from Leeds, and at 21, you're told these are the keys to the branch, you know, you're opening up. And it was a steep learning curve, one that I really enjoyed. And as a consequence, you know, I managed branches around Holborn, Fleet Street, Bayswater. And then I moved to Chester because Halifax and Bank of Scotland merged. Yeah. And then I got to really practice my my love and passion of helping people in that banking sector. So I've travelled around quite a bit. And when I look back at my history, you know, then I joined Selfridges on Oxford Street, which was great learning. Again, I had an amazing boss who helped me to develop those real important people skills around communicating. You know, I'd never done a disciplinary before, and here I was terminating people on a regular basis. I'd never been to an employment tribunal and defended a company before, but here I was stood in court defending the decision to terminate somebody. And that's on the backdrop of having like Beyonce coming to do her perfume launch and like Kylie doing a book launch in the store.
I mean, that must have been a surreal experience working in Selfridges, one of like the most prestigious brands in the UK.
Oh yeah, it was phenomenal. And I was young, single at the time, and working crazy hours. I'll be honest, I don't think I've ever worked as hard as I did when I worked in retail, because just the volume of it, you know, the store that was open 365 days a year, you know, it was open throughout the whole night where you're replenishing. And it had a really fun vibe to it. You know, there was a lot happening in London at that time. So it definitely helped. And my boss, you know, she just gave me exposure to learn. But she also coaxed me into understanding that the speed by which I was operating wasn't necessarily conducive to bringing a team along with me. And that was my biggest learning.
That's something that I often explore called pace setting leadership. And I remember when I was a young leader, a wise old leader took me to one side and said something like, Cole, you know, when you're leading from the front and you're trying to motivate people into taking action, always look into the rearview mirror periodically, he said, because you don't know how many people can sustain the kind of energy that you've got right now and how many people are falling by the wayside. Probably some of the best advice I've had. And it sounds so similar to, because when you are young, as a young leader, you don't have the level of wisdom that we have now, but you have the zest, don't you? And of course, it's easy to get carried away with that.
Absolutely. And I think at the time I was thinking, what do you mean people like are not keeping up? You know, this is very normal. But it's normal for you. And that's what I mean is I feel throughout the course of my career, no matter where I've worked in financial services, banking, and then, you know, I moved on to join HSBC in Canary Wharf and then Tesco's, I've always had great ambassadors behind me that have seen something.
So you, what you're saying is, I mean, you are the produce or the product of having great leaders around you, great mentors, great leaders, and you're testament to what that can do. So, you know, if there are people listening, this is why we do this podcast. You know, it really is about if you can be the very best leader that you can be and you develop other great leaders, that's a legacy that you leave behind. You know, it's their leadership style ultimately that is your legacy, and you're a testament to that.
Yeah, and I'm still in touch with, you know, vast majority of them. I still drop them a message, and because I do have that gratitude moment. I mean, when I was just won this contract for USAID in Ghana, and I remember getting on the flight and feeling quite emotional, and you know, and a tear was kind of falling down my cheek, and the air hostess asked me, she said, you know, are you okay? And I said, well, actually, somebody's asked me to go to Ghana to pay for me to go. So I feel a bit emotional, and I think she must have been thinking, who is this crazy lady? But I definitely have those moments, those pinch moments where I'm thinking, is this really happening to me? When I was entering the world of work, I didn't see as many people who looked like me or sounded like me. And when I'd go for an interview, I'd almost be like looking around to see who else is here. Who else is here? And that's what I always advocate to people, is what you represent should never be underestimated. Because, you know, it's all about representation in all forms. Be it a female, be it a minority, be it a working mom. It's so important that we stand up and we talk about that.
I love that. And, you know, just on this whole issue of representation, and you're coming at it from the responsibility that you have as a role model to play out. And it's certainly something that was very acute with me. You know, when I joined the police service back in 1983, I was literally a brown speck in a sea of white. But I was always conscious that other people would be looking at me in terms of how I carried myself and how I performed and how I spoke, and also that other people of color would be looking at me and gain some level of inspiration or even becoming demotivated by my action. So I felt that responsibility lying on my shoulders fairly heavily throughout my entire career as I went up. And that's sort of where you're coming from. But there's another issue around representation where we talk about, you know, representation is key. And I don't know, my views on that have slightly changed over the years. I was a big proponent of representation. You know, back in 1999, I sat down with home secretaries in the police service saying that we need to have targets. But my views on that have changed a bit, in so much as you can have people or minoritized groups represented, but if the individuals aren't performing to the betterment of other minoritized groups, then representation doesn't actually achieve anything. And I think for me, EDI, the whole concept of equality, diversity, and inclusion, should be about recognizing that every single person in your organization is different and not to homogenize people into these protected characteristics that we very often work with. What is your experience and thoughts on that?
So I think there's definitely a shift to move away from filling the numbers, right? To have, you know, I think from my experience, the impact of having a leader in role who is doing it because they feel it's the thing that they should be doing, as opposed to what they believe in doing, it is a huge distinction. Because in my experience, we all come to work with our own biases, right? We all have misconceptions, as I often face. It's like, you live in Tanzania, you live in Africa, is it safe? You know? And it's really strange because those biases are very normal. It is built up on our experiences, our approaches. And I think as my work has taught me, the most authentic leaders are the ones that are willing to have diversity of thought, real diversity of thought in the room.
And that's what it's about at the end of the day, isn't it? EDI should be about that diversity of thought, which then leads to creativity, innovation, agility, adaptability in this evolving world. That's what it's about, surely.
Absolutely. And when I see it in practice, I have that moment of like, wow. So the first time I won a contract for USAID in Ghana, I was asked to facilitate. So this is not this year, this was last year. I flew across and I was asked to facilitate a retreat for about 30 delegates mm-hmm. who worked within the health office. And the most senior lady was Indian. Her number two was Nigerian American and her number three was a Ghanaian, right? This was their senior leadership team. So in terms of diversity of thought and approaches, it was being realized in that room, right?
Brilliant.
And it was fantastic to see it because it was real. People were talking about their differing approaches to solving problems around malnutrition, malaria eradication, you know, things that are really impacting people's lives. But through the lens of this is how I'm seeing it, as opposed to this is the way that you should all be seeing it.
But there's a challenge within creating that culture of diversity of thought. In order for us to get this rich diversity of thought coming into our organizations, we then have to challenge ourselves around the traditional mindset of the organization. We need to break down that groupthink mentality, the echo chambers that exist. We need to be brave enough to listen to something that traditionally we may not have listened to in the organization. And I found that to be a huge challenge in the police service and certainly in the public sector in the UK, where they seem to be not so much stuck, but they have a traditionalist approach at the very root of everything that they do, at the very foundation. So it takes a really brave leader to allow new thoughts, new ideas, new ways of being coming through to influence the debate. And I think that's the challenge, isn't it? To have that courage to create an environment where people can say something different.
And it's about recognizing it. I mean, I'm working with a client at the moment in Tanzania and we're recruiting a senior leader to support this organization. And, you know, the founders of this company are like, listen, we are not the CEOs going forward in this role. We recognize we need to bring somebody different in.
Yeah.
Because if we carry on growing this business, which has done in phenomenally successfully over the last, you know, 5-6 years, we're just going to keep getting the same problems and the same issues. We're looking at things through the same lens. And I always use the analogy, my dad loves cricket. So when the cricket's on, my dad never answers the phone, you know, he's always...
he sounds like my father-in-law. Every time I go to see him, I remember when the World Cup was on and every time I came to see him, he had to give me a break. He was literally watching every single match. I said, Dad, how on earth are you doing this? But he was like, it's a job call. It's a job.
True. But it's in the that, you know, using that cricketing analogy, you know, not everybody in the team needs to be a fast bowler. Not everybody yes. needs to be a wicket keeper.
Exactly.
Everybody needs to know actually what their role is. And in this particular exercise that I'm doing with this company is recognizing what we don't have in the team, right? It's great recognizing that, you know, as entrepreneurs, we solve problems this way. But as a consequence, it might mean that we miss out on other areas. And that diversity of approaches is really important. And the other example I always say to people is like, you and I might be working in the same team, but we might butt heads for whatever reason. And in this example, I always say, you might go to IKEA and buy a table and bring it home. And you open the box and you read the instructions and you check everything is in the box. And then you start following the process. Whereas I might go to IKEA, buy the same table, rip open the box and start creating the table and say, Cole, I know what a table looks like. Why do I need to follow instructions, right? And typically having two perspectives in the same team to build the same table can cause friction, especially if we don't recognize that that's the preferred approach. It's not right. It's not wrong. It's not good. It's not bad. It's just saying we can look at problems through different lenses.
Yes, I love that. And this whole concept of looking through different lenses is what gives us a much wider perspective of the world, isn't it? And we have to also recognize that whenever we look through the world through our own lens, we're only getting a very limited perspective because of our biases and because of the way that we perceive the world, because of the paradigms what we hold individually. So wouldn't it be better to get a much more 360 degree view of the world by talking to people, having people around you that think differently, see the world differently, have different lenses, and it adds so much more to the team. I just want to talk about your vast experience around so many organizations. And of course, you know, people are at the heart of everything that we do. What have you learned around getting the best out of your people? I mean, the whole idea of this conversation is really about being human-centric. So what have you learned about getting the best out of people? What have organizations got wrong? What have they got right? And what do you think we need to do in the modern world?
What I noticed during COVID was there was a huge shift from being very employer-centric solutions being offered to employees to very employee-centric solutions being offered. And you saw things such as remote working, you know, more flexibility, because there was a pivot. And I saw it. There was a pivot where organizations recognized that actually people have a choice. And maybe COVID was that moment in time that allowed people to recognize that choice is real, you know?
Yeah.
And what I think as a consequence, as a positive consequence of COVID, was it made employers realize that we are not, employees are not obligated to stay. They have choice and they're happy to utilize that choice. That shift, I think, caused the opening up of a lot more dialogue conversations with leaders, with their staff, to say, look, how can I keep you? Because I think there was a real fear that there's a skills drain.
Well, of course, we had things like great resignation, quiet quitting, loud quitting, unprecedented industrial action in this country. And I think you're absolutely right. I think COVID was a pivot point for the workplace cultures going forward. And yes, we became more employee-centric, but also employees had, or human beings had, this mindset shift where they recalibrated their priorities. What's important to me? Because we're so close to death, we came right down to the bottom end of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Yeah. We thought, well, what's important to me? Well, life and death is important. So what do I need to do to be psychologically safe? That was a new language that came in, right? And I think I did a talk just a couple of weeks ago at a university in Cambridge, where we were talking about the different eras that we've experienced in the workplace culture. And from my perspective, in the 1980s, everything was about the what. What is it that we're doing? How can we make it more efficient? The 1990s built on the how and became the era of the how, where we started looking at, you know, things like Kaizen and ISO 9001 and best value, value for money, all of these kind of initiatives. That was about streamlining, making things much more efficient. And then in the noughties, we had Simon Sinek with his landmark talk around Start With Why in his book, and where he talked about, you know, companies really need to understand why they're doing what they're doing, and people will buy into that more. But I think COVID introduced a new era, the era of the who, that it's all around the humans. It's all around the people, whether they be our employees or our clients and our stakeholders. It's really about relationship building and understanding how do we get the best out of people. I think you've just put it really, really lovely in the way that you've put it across. I think we are in a new era, but don't you find that many, many organizations still don't get it? Because, you know, I still hear of organizations, large organizations, who say, it's about time we got everybody back into work, you know, almost get back to where we were pre-COVID. And I don't think that we ever will, to be quite honest. I think the world has reshaped itself.
I just think that opportunity of having choice is so important, right? I mean, I love what I do. And the reason I love it is because it allows me the flexibility of being able to pick and choose not just what I do, but who I do it with, right? My clients are people actually who I really like. They're nice people. And they are people that, because that's my filter. When I have the initial conversations with people, I think I'm investing my time and my effort and my energy into solving this problem for this person, be it a cultural change program or an organization redesign. And I, in my own mind, have a checklist to think, do I really want to do this? Right? Mm. And I've got choice. And sometimes if it's, and I'm giving away a secret here, sometimes if it's not really what I want, I might add an extra zero to this is how much it might cost as a way of out. And then other times, you know, I'm like, yeah, jump in, both feet. How can I help you? How can we do this? And I think it's that choice of recognizing that where you invest your time and you put your energy is so important, especially when you get older. I mean, I'm 2 years off 50, and I'm thinking, listen, I've been doing this for a long time.
Yeah, I've got a few years on you, Tovinda, but I completely understand, you know, as you do get older, you do realise within yourself that you want to invest your time in the right places with the right people. So my filter is values. That if I sense that these people, whoever it is, comes from the same value perspective as I do, then I'm happy to work with them. But if they don't, if they seem so far removed from my values, I just think to myself, it's going to take a lot of my mental energy just on building that relationship, and I don't need to do that. And it's the same with yourself. You know, I it's the values I've sensed from within you, from your posts, and because they are quite authentic posts, right? So it's the values that I see within you that then cause me to reach out to you. So I think that's really, really important. So as you do get older, and I am a bit older than you, but I'm not going to tell you how much, but I am a bit older than you, but it becomes very important for me to spend the time that I have with the right kind of people and the right kind of clients. I absolutely get that. So we are in this world of, you know, where we are sensing values, thinking about values, understanding whether I could work with this person and be comfortable working with this person and enjoy that relationship. The era of the who is here, and I don't think that we can go back to pre-2020. I just don't sense that people have elevated in terms of their awareness. I don't think that they would want to go back to an organization or to a time where they didn't have the kind of choice that they've got right now. We've become spoiled with choice, right?
As human beings, we are looking at our own needs, right? What's going to work for me? What's going to work for my family?
Yes.
What's going to work for me financially? I think it has become a lot more centered around your individual needs. And, you know, those things like those job for lives that we heard of when I started my graduate program all those years ago, now kind of seem like the rarity, you know.
I think we live in a very transient kind of world, don't we?
And you can have many jobs. You don't have to pick up, I mean, go to a careers advisor and, you know, do the same job. It's not a job for life. I mean, that's why I really enjoy what I do, because the variety that I experience doesn't feel like I'm doing the same job.
I was talking to somebody the other day. I heard this really fascinating talk around intergenerational thinking. And this lady was doing this phenomenal talk, really. And she was saying, did you know that in the current workspace, we have the capability or the potential to actually have 5 generations of people working in the same organization? And just her saying that made me take a step back, because of course every single generation will have a different way of thinking. And of course, one of the things that she was talking about was this transience that exists in, you know, the Generation Z kind of generation, where people want a flavor or a taste or an experience, and then to move on to get another experience, which for my generation certainly wasn't the case. My generation valued you for the longevity of you staying with an organization. And I remember in the police service, people used to look at those. We had certain people who would go from police force to police force to police force to police force, just to, you know, move up the ladder or get different experience. And they were frowned upon. They'd be saying, look at that person. They don't stay with one police force any, and it's an identical role that they're playing, that they're performing in another force. I think that isn't, you know, compared to where we are right now, where people go from industry to industry, that is quite dated now, really. So I think we're living in this era where choice is so important, and our traditionalist beliefs that many senior officers senior people may still hold around longevity and 30-year careers and all of that kind of stuff is being challenged, and we need to get used to that.
The world that we exist in allows for that to happen more, you know, the social media, the television. I mean, I grew up with what, 4 channels on the TV, yeah.
We had 2.
You know, so the amount of choice that my children now have compared to what I had growing up is, you know, we couldn't compare.
It's an incredible world. You know, when you reflect just on one lifetime and how much it's changed and how much it can yet change, and therefore how people will change, how can organizations stay so agile that they're able to, you know, stay relevant in the minds of their employees? How can they create stickability, do you think?
Well, ultimately, it's survival of the fittest, you know. I mean, where the space where I navigate, I work a lot with entrepreneurs. And that entrepreneurial mentality, I think, demonstrates the importance of valuing the people that you have. Because your organization is not going to thrive if you're seen as a revolving door, right?
Yeah.
And maybe that's easier to influence when you've got a smaller culture, right? When you've got fewer people. So there is so much expectation of leaders in big multinationals to have that level of influence on the people that they manage, and for the people that they manage, have that level of influence on people they manage, right?
And isn't that how you create a culture, right? You focus on where you can create that influence, create the best influence that you can do, in the hope that they then go on to create the better influence beneath it, and so forth and so on, right down into the front line.
And that magic sauce that you call culture, and people say, oh, you know, how do I create the best culture? And I always say, like, ask people the question and then just wait for the answer and then act on what they say. Yeah. You can do engagement surveys till you're blue in the face. But unless you do something with that information, at least even acknowledge, thank you for completing the survey. You know, people will start rolling their eyes when it comes around again next year, because I think, well, nothing's going to change, because nothing does change.
I was having a conversation last night with a client organization where they have got some significant challenges ahead of them, let's say, around budget. And they're not used to this. Because for years and years, decades, they've done really, really well. And because of circumstances outside of their control, the landscape has changed. Now they've got some difficult decisions to make around budget. And they were talking about the communication that they were having with their staff and how they are surprised at how their staff are responding to some of the messaging. And for me, I said, well, we really need to strip that right down to its very basic human level, and understanding where the staff are, the level of uncertainty after decades of stability and growth, where they are right now. They're not used to this environment. So how good is your messaging? How human is your messaging? How authentic is your messaging? These are the kind of things that they're going to be looking for, the transparency, the vulnerability even in some of the leadership messaging, just to, for them to know that the leaders are feeling the pain just as much as everybody else, and they're going to do everything they possibly can to make it as easy as they possibly can. And I think sometimes they need to hear that kind of stuff. I think what happens with many organizations is when they are in these challenges, they tend to become very robotic in the way they do things. They adhere to policies, and sometimes that can make things seem very, very sterile and inhumane. And you must have seen this so many times from your HR world, right?
I've done numerous restructures, reorganizations in various guises for lots of different companies. And when I'm hand-holding or I'm coaching the line manager to have these conversations, the advice I always give them is treat people how you would want to be treated.
Exactly.
Right? Use that same empathy and compassion. You're not changing the messaging. You're being really honest with people and saying the organization is restructuring or we are going through a change. And as a consequence, your role is at risk or there are going to be changes to that role. Here is how we are going to support you through that transition, right? And it's not what you say, it's how you say.
How you say it, absolutely, yeah. And I've worked with so many HR professionals over the years that have, you know, what I call the traditionalist HR professionals, the ones who are very defensive, very much around the policy. And, you know, I've got some very big decisions to make, multi-million pound savings and, you know, people's lives at risks. And the HR professional comes to me and they've been very cold, very sort of policy driven. Thankfully, we've got a new style of HR person coming out now, much more authentic, much more human. And I think that's the way forward. I can't believe 30 minutes have flown by already, Tavinder. I could talk to you literally all day long.
Oh, thank you very much.
Thank you for sharing so much value and wisdom with us. And I think that last point around not what you say about how you say demonstrates the importance of being human-centric in your leadership style. So I hope this has added value to many, many people who are going to be listening to it right now. I'm sure it has. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Please do subscribe and click on notifications for new content. And of course, connect with me on LinkedIn. Take care. Have a great day.